Hello, this is Brian Madden, and you're listening to Brian Madden Live. So what we attempted to do, which maybe you heard, I didn't hear in my speakers, was play the music from the music and intro from our very first podcast that we did 10 years ago, and that was. So I assume everyone listening heard that, right? My intro and then, yeah. Okay, so it's been 10 years since we started podcast. We called it Brian Madden Live in those days. The intro music, the trombone intro music, was actually written, composed, and recorded by Jack, who's also a trombone player. And so that was actually him. And Jack, you're joining us today from our studio in San Francisco. Hello.
Good morning.
We've got Gabe with us from Omaha. Hello, Gabe.
Hello.
And reprising his role as guest on today's podcast, Kevin Goodman.
Hello, guys. How are you?
And where are you? Are you in Atlanta today?
In Atlanta today, yes.
Yeah. We're looking forward to hearing more about T-Scale today.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I've had three jobs since that last podcast. What can you guys say?
Same thing. Yeah. Same exact job.
I try repeatedly to get fired, but it doesn't work. So the music, by the way, this was, you know, podcasting. So in those days, the podcast, it was not live. It was just pre-recorded and then posted, because I think live streaming wasn't a thing back then.
Real player.
Yeah. And so, Jack, you recorded that podcast like with a multi-track recorder, right? You played it once and then had the second part and played it in your headphones. Like, you played all four parts, like track by track by track, right?
Oh, there were more than four parts, but yes.
where did the drum music and stuff, like the cymbals? Was that like a...
We had a cymbal. Somewhere there's a cymbal around with a BrianMadden.com asset tag on it.
Don't tell Tech Target. They're going to take it. They're going to be like, hey, you did not disclose that when it was bought.
No, it's okay. It's been amortized. I saw the amortization schedule.
Yeah, it's been depreciated. So let me ask. Okay, so Kevin, you are now... So 10 years ago, you were with RTO Software, and a company you founded, and you're the sort of archaeological remnants of that still exist with your Twitter handle being called RTO Kevin.
Yes, so most people don't know this, but RTO stood for Restate the Obvious.
not runtime optimizations.
Remember our CEO was Berndt, and he was trying to turn that, kind of like Windows NT means new technology. He was trying to turn that into something we could actually use. But I used to get accused of doing that all the time. Kevin, you're just restating the obvious, for Christ's sakes. Let's move on.
So, look, I know those listening are now thinking, okay, we've got 4 minutes into this podcast talking about nothing. I want to continue for a second. At the time, Kevin, the first podcast was about like DLL rebasing, right? Like, because that's what RTO T-Scale did. And it did, like, you know, when you've got multiple instances of DLLs running, people can listen to the podcast to find out the details of what the heck that thing was. And I know you licensed that technology to Citrix, and it was included, I think maybe is now still included. My question is DLL rebasing, is that like still a thing in modern times, or has that been fixed now?
Yeah, no longer. So what happened is that was part of XenApp, or MetaFrame anyway, all the way up, I think, in all the 32-bit versions of XenApp. But it really makes no sense in the 64-bit versions due to typically having address space layout randomization turned on. So the concept of rebasing is if you could get everything to load in its base address, then you would not cause copy-on-write for each DLL as each person or process within XenApp used it. But what happens in 64-bit land is every one of the every one of the DLLs that Microsoft provides, you know, kernel 32, you know, user 32, et cetera, have a different base address in every process. So it became more and more difficult for, you know, you to get the base address right. So when you have layout randomization turned on, Microsoft does something in there in which you just don't get the benefits that you were getting in 32-bit land. So I don't know anyone who's using it. I do not believe it's in the 64-bit versions of ZenApp anymore. I've lost track, actually. I mean, I still think the memory optimization stuff is in there. I still think they're third-party selling the memory optimization stuff. And I think that is also useless when you're on a when you're on a virtualization system who's already controlling the CPU for you. But, you know, it was 10-year-old technology, so you knew it was going to get obsolete sooner or later.
Yeah, it's interesting that the – and I guess also it was a kernel memory issue too, which in 64-bit we don't have the 2 gigabyte kernel limit, and, you know, it's just a different world nowadays.
Yeah, it is, and we've moved on to bigger and better problems. But if you took a 30,000-foot level of what we were trying to solve in 2005, we're probably still trying to solve that today, and that is how can we get people off of physical machines and onto virtual desktops? You've made a career out of it, a very good one, by the way, because you're the best at this, but basically, isn't that all we've been talking about the last 10 years?
Yeah, make it run faster. By the way, the other hot stories of August 2005 were Citrix Access Essentials, you know, the SMB version. So Presentation Server 4 was a product, and then Citrix was doing Citrix Access Essentials. And so that was like a big story. And then also Longhorn, which was in 2008. Like the same stories.
Server 2003.
R2.
Wasn't that their paw? This was 2005. So it would have been 2003 R2 then.
Yeah, okay. Bear Paw.
I only know code names that were made in the last year now.
I want to get to that because we left last week's show with a lot of confusion around code
names. Oh, Vista Server.
All right, Vista. So, But Kevin, you had 3 jobs since then. So RTO Software was bought by VMware in, I don't know, 2009 or something like that?
Something like that, yeah. 10, 9, I don't know, yeah.
And then you became – so they bought – I mean, RTO – like VMware bought all of RTO except for the T-Scale part because T-Scale had been licensed to Citrix and that sort of stayed as its own and VMware bought everything else, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, so they call that an asset deal. A lot of that is for exactly what you said. So very many companies have within them what the acquiring company calls toxic assets. And one of the toxic assets, could you imagine VMware being responsible to fix the bugs within the T-Scale portion of, you know, ZenApp? They didn't really think that was a great idea. Could you imagine at the time Citrix wanting to have VMware have access to their source code? So
right.
We had to figure out what to do about that.
Oh yeah, because you had source code access with the deal for Citrix, right? So
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, we had to step through this and make sure it worked. So
yeah, and then you were at VMware for I don't know a couple of years, but at the time, I think one of the big reasons VMware bought you was for the profile management. You had a virtual profiles product.
Yeah, so that came along. That came along probably in 08 or 09, virtual profiles. And here we go again, still trying to solve the problem of getting users to log on quickly. And at the time, remember, disk space was absorbent, and everyone knew what IOPS were and how much they cost and stuff like that. And so this was a ploy to reduce your disk space cost but still get you to log on within a reasonable amount of time.
Which is crazy. We're talking about back at the time. We're talking like 2010 now. But
yeah.
2010 even, there wasn't – you weren't filling your servers with SSDs in 2010. And then so – but now, is that gone? I mean, so VMware bought a Medio, I don't know, 6 months ago. And
did it ever take shape? I mean, I don't recall.
Did whatever
it
takes.
I think it took a long time before anything that resembled the virtual profiles came out.
Well,
so,
you know, so
how much of that did they end up using?
Cycles, oh, it's called View Persona now. It's probably, I think if you go look on, I was talking to Kid Coder. Remember Kid Coder? He wrote that.
Yeah, Eric Tatum or something like that?
Yeah, not too long ago. And
is he still at VMware?
I believe he is, yeah.
Is he still a kid?
No, now he's like Man Coder. he's still Kid Coder to me, though, because I've aged 10 years in that process as well. So, but he was saying on the, and I didn't look at it, but on Ruben's survey about UEM vendors, mm-hmm. that View Persona is like in the top five of popularity with number of production seats, mainly it and UPM, maybe because you get them mm-hmm. for free, right? But yeah, so here's the thing. They buy a Midio for two reasons, in my opinion. One, who's trying to save disk space anymore? That whole concept of just-in-time file system almost doesn't make sense with today's cheap.
Yeah, because everything, and storage just does that. Like every file is almost kind of like just in time now because it's all sort of virtualized in the back end. So,
yeah, so that whole part of it went away. And then, you know, Midio has all that onboarding stuff, you know, so all of that made a lot of sense to pick that up. And I guess we'll find out how far along they are integrating that come this VMworld.
Yeah. So this is interesting because now your new company, FS Logix, which I don't know if we talked about that much before on a podcast anyway, but so your history is you build a company or you build a product that solves a problem, and then that problem eventually just becomes solved in the world, and which is a good thing because it means that everyone gets benefits to what, you know, your stuff does. So how soon does this mean, like, crystal ball, if I look forward 10 years, like, I'm hoping that what FS Logix does today is not needed.
You know, if history proves right, then the technologies will come along, and, you know, I'm hoping in 10 years Kevin Goodman isn't needed so I can finally retire.
Hey, didn't you already retire a couple of times?
So, hey, newsflash, pro tip out there, do not retire before the age of 55. It will age you beyond belief. Okay?
You can only play so much golf.
Oh, my gosh. You can only
– And poker.
Yeah, and poker. Oh, yeah. So –
Well, so how about – like when this went down so you're at VMware, and I remember – you told me a story that you just did other jobs at VMware. You didn't sort of babysit the RTO products because they were your babies, and it's, you know, VMware is going to integrate them. So you just went off and did sort of other things at VMware. And then, you know, you left VMware, you create FS Logix, and you built that with Randy Cook. And Randy, I know, was one of the sort of like early on sort of inventors of app virtualization. I don't know if that's saying that right?
I think that's fair to characterize it that way. He's got 32 patents awarded for all kinds of application virtualization. And he was originally in a startup that was acquired by Symantec.
And that startup, by the way, was called FS Logix, ending with a C, right? So, and then I know RTO did a OEM deal with Symantec also back in the day. So I assume that's when you met him and you guys went and built this new company.
Yeah, so, I mean, so he started FS Logix with this purpose of making it easy for you to get your applications to your users, the whole goal trying to be the system administrator's best friend, you know, and give that guy some extra time in the day. And it ended up at Symantec, and like all good products, it you know,
it was
only making, like, I forget what the number was, in the 30s of millions of dollars. So consequently, that wasn't good enough for Symantec, which needs a product to be, you know, making billions of dollars to show up on their balance sheet. And it exactly what happened. The product kind of went by the wayside. So, you know, Randy got frustrated and left there. And I ran into him after having left VMware. And we had a complaint session about what's wrong with the industry, and probably like every young kid that goes and runs for city council or mayor, we got so frustrated with what's wrong with the industry, we decided to do something about it. And hence the second regeneration of FS Logic called FS Logics.
And that was now, I mean, you guys were at Bribe Forum, like this was your third Bribe Forum, I think, as FS Logics, right? So like you've been around a little while.
Yeah. If you remember, we came out of stealth. We chose Bribe Forum to come out of stealth because, for the same reasons back then that there are today, VMworld doesn't have its own EUC track. Consequently, I know 25,000 people are going to show up next week for VMworld, but try to have them find little tiny FS Logics in that group where, you know, you're up against the guys that are monitoring and trying to reduce your VM sprawl and trying to sell you all kinds of other things that have to do with the platform.
And they're giving away a car. You know, you can't give away a car either. That's how they get 25,000 leads.
Yeah. And it would be fantastic. But then again, you go to Bribe Forum and it's the exact market we're looking to try to get. You know, it isn't, it's only a, sorry to say this, maybe one day it'll be the same, but it's a fraction of the number of attendees. You know, it's a percentage of the number of attendees, but each and every one of them have the problem we solve. So we just, you know, that's why we chose Bribe Forum.
It's a fraction of the attendees. Like it's a percentage. That percentage is one. So FS Logics, feel like maybe, you know, I don't even know how you describe what it is. It's not quite app virtualization. It's sort of, you know, addressing app management, app compatibility. And I remember talking to you about FS Logics, your original plan, 2-3 years ago before it was even launched. And I was like, yes, this is awesome. And now it seems like there's a nice little ecosystem. Like this is what, I mean, like App Volumes from VMware does something like this. I think Liquidware does something like this. What's the other?
AppDisks from Citrix.
So this whole thing,
yeah.
This whole thing, this whole modern app virtualization. Like the way I explain it to people is that, you know, AppV and ThinApp. I don't know if ThinApp's still a thing. You know, we were using them for sort of dynamic application installation. Within, you know, VDI and ZenApp environments, but really they were built to solve, you know, app isolation and app compatibility problems. Like the
problems
way we
that we
using...
had back in 1999 and 2000.
Yeah.
You know, when we were trying to run Access 97 and 2.0 at the same time. That's what that was born out of. And nowadays, yeah, it's just so different. I think there's 8 companies on that list, Brian. There's like CloudHouse, Spoon, Numescent, Liquidware, those companies. I mean, there's probably 8 different companies that are trying to manage applications in a new way. For like the problems that we have today, not the problems that we had 15 years ago.
Yeah, so it just goes to show you how hard the problem is and the fact it's not solved yet, you know? 10 years ago on that podcast, if you asked me to look 10 years into the future, I might agreed with Gartner that said, you know, 30 to 50% of your desktops would be virtual. I believe the reason they're not is because of how hard it is with the applications. The fact that there's 8 companies going strong. I mean, we have 50,000 installed seats right now in those 3 short years. The fact that we have that and this market is supporting all these other companies out there tells you the problem isn't solved yet, and it's not going away anytime soon either.
I saw you at Bribe Forum in London standing in your booth talking to people from 2 other vendors that do this. And after they left, they said, what are you doing talking to the enemy? And he goes, and you said that, hey, you know, there's a billion seats in this market. There's enough room for all of us.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, I wasn't exaggerating. The Windows 10 launch, what did they say? They have 750 million corporate Windows 7 licenses. Another 250 million combined XP and Windows 8 licenses. There are 1 billion Windows licenses out there. You care to, and don't use, please don't quote VMware or Citrix numbers, but either you guys care to give me a guess of what you think, because I don't actually know how many seats have actually been virtualized, count, you know, Citrix and VMware and their competitors in there.
I don't know. If you're counting ZenApp and everything, like 100 million maybe?
That's what I was thinking, but you have to have ZenApp.
Yeah, you have to have ZenApp to get there. Yes. Yeah. I'm not counting those ghost seats that I counted when I threw in
You worked for VMware.
Seats into your ELA. Yeah, I'm not counting those. Although, by the way, just in all fairness, every time I get up and talk about my days at VMware, somebody tweets and says, you know, a lot of stuff has changed with it since then. So I should say that out loud. A lot of stuff has changed like that. The version of Vue that they have today, this is not your father's Vue Horizon. It is, a much better product than what we had. It's much more feature complete, so forth and so on. I read on Brian Madden where you guys are debating if it's caught up to Zen Desktop or not yet. So that just tells you how far that product has come since I worked there. And because I haven't worked there since 2012, I can't take any credit for that because there are smarter people for me that were able to pull this off.
So what I'm hearing is you got out of there, shit got better.
In a hurry. Holy Well, take a look. So when we were at VMware, though, and this is a comment I have whenever you guys start a VMware versus Citrix. When we were at VMware, and we just hired an ex-VMware guy here at FS Logix, and we were just talking before the show. The competition isn't Citrix. When you're sitting there from where VMware is, the competition isn't Citrix. The competition is business as usual. You have I'll agree, your 100 million seats, which means you have 900 million seats that could possibly be your customers. And if you get a market penetration of even 25%, you more than, you know, yeah, 2.5 times what you're doing now, that'd be fantastic, right?
And Citrix had such a strong, fanatical install base, you know, especially because they were the first ones in the world of Windows to sort of push this whole, you know, centralized computing model and all that kind of stuff. So people grew up with Citrix. They were very channel focused in the day. And people bled Citrix blood. And so I think on that, it's just way easier to convert a non-virtual desktop into a VMware than it is to try to convert Citrix into VMware.
Yeah, we used to see it all the time on our, the quote-unquote desktop modernization project. We'd go in there for the kickoff. And if the kickoff was being run from the server side, wow, this deal's going VMware. Go ahead and put it in the forecast. If it's being run from the desktop side, there's a good chance they already had some Zenap in there, and it was going to be a dogfight to try to win that business. And part of that reason why was then the admin would go, they're not getting my vCenter passwords. You know, what rack are you planning on putting it in? And instead of converting physical desktops, you're just sniping at each other, and all it did was delay the deal. And I had one guy tell me he walked into his CIO's office every quarter. The CIO had a pen to a requisition order and says, do I buy these physical desktops or not? Yeah, go ahead and buy them, boss. We still haven't figured this out. You know, so that's who won. When and where I think there's a bajillion seats out here and we ought to go out and carve them out and get them and let the best team win. Citrix and VMware to some extent ought to do that as well. That's the real competition, is business as usual.
Well, so what do you guys, I visited you in Atlanta a couple months ago, and one of the conversations we had while we were sitting in traffic and it was about 7,000 degrees outside was about, you know, one of the things I like about FS Logix is that everything you do, it sort of works at the Windows level, so it works on physical as well as virtual, you know. So and I've always been a big fan of, you know, create sort of like a Windows strategy, and whatever you do for managing, it's everything, security and applications and profile and personalization and identity and all that kind of stuff, you know, apply these techniques to all your desktops, because the delivery mechanism is merely a form factor. You know, you've got, some are laptops, some are desktops, some are big laptops, some are small laptops, some are virtual desktops, some are VMs and clients, some are Zen apps, you know, it doesn't matter. And so to that end, what you're doing is going after the sort of Windows application management market, not necessarily the VDI market or the Zen app market. You have customers? Are you seeing uptake on people doing what you're doing on physical desktops as well as virtual?
Well, yes. So very few of our customers are virtual only, right? So all of the enterprise have some physical. We do have some desktop as a service companies. Obviously, they're all virtual. But everybody else is under this, you know, mandate that I need to cut costs, I need to up my management time. And whether it's warranted or not, a lot of people believe if they put the desktop behind the glass wall, it'll become more secure. I mean, you and I, the group on this phone needs that's you have to do more than that to make that a reality. But they're all under that mandate to do that. And so, we talk to those guys. Most cases, what we're doing is helping them. It's in the process of the migration, many of them. The problem you have with us is we expect you to have a little bit more. We use more storage space than you probably typically used to. When we first talked to our guys, wow, this is counterintuitive to what I've always been told. Have a small base image and then, you know, deliver the apps afterwards at runtime based on who the user is. Where what we say at FS Logix is install all the apps into the base image so they'll be there, and we'll use our layering technology, because that's what the industry has chose to use to label us, just make sure that you only see the apps that you have. Well, you can go out and buy a 2 terabyte drive now, super cheap. But if you're thinking on the level of using an FS Logix, a lot of times what you're thinking, if I'm going to spend money, why don't I see if I can't get them virtualized? I don't know that I want to buy a workstation with a 2 terabyte drive that can only be used by that user while he's sitting at this desk, you know. Instead, maybe I'll spend that same exact money and I'll put that user up into the cloud, so to speak, so he can use it from anywhere. And with that thought in mind, we get a lot of, people looking at us for that. But if they're really looking to save money, then they're not looking to buy new hardware. So a lot of cat times we don't run into that. Of course, we do partner with some people. We used to partner with a company that went out of business, so that didn't work out too well. And I know you're the fans of like Gentoo. Those guys, we're partnered with them if you have physical desktops now. And it's the best of both worlds. You get only the apps per user that you want based on your policy. And Gentoo doesn't require you to buy a newer, more storage space. It works out perfectly.
That's perfect. Gentoo is the ones, for those listening who are not familiar with them, that they're like what Ardent's was, or Citrix PBS, and disk image streaming. And that's perfect, because that way you can have one disk image that's on your servers that's like whatever. You have all your apps installed in that base image, but just the blocks are going across the wire kind of as they're needed. And then with FS Logix sort of managing access to that, then you don't even see the apps that you don't have access to, and they never go across the wire or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a user last week that uses Gentoo. I was up in Toronto, and they're based in Toronto. And one of the attendees at my VDI show came up to me afterwards and said, "Man, you got to hear about these guys named Gentoo. They're awesome." And I said, "Oh, I know that. Yeah." So he, it was cool to hear a user's experience with them.
I was just going to say, Gabe is the one who put me together with Gentoo. He said, "Hey, have you heard Gentoo?" So I Googled Gentoo and said, "No, who are they?"
Oh, because it's Gentoo. Gentoo.
No, Gentu, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Oh, geez.
It's Gentoo. Right. Well, yeah. And I'd forgotten. So I had a briefing with them, I don't know, a month and a half ago. It was after my last roadshow and before this one, and I had gone into my deck and made a point to mention Gentoo, but it was just a black slide with the white word Gentoo on it, and I'd forgotten all about it. So I got to that slide in the presentation, and I'm like, oh yeah, Gentoo.
Next slide. And then on the in terms of base image size on a virtual environment, you know, that's not even an issue anymore, because all the storage, like, it doesn't matter now. If you have, if you want to build a 200 gigabyte base image that has, all your enterprise apps installed, and then use something like FS Logix to show or hide them, based on the users that need them. A few years ago, that would have been unfathomable. But now, I mean, all the storage is virtualizing everything behind the scenes. So if you have 200 gig base image, even if these are personal images, they're not really taking up that much space on the back end storage. So just kind of like the storage industry moving on, I feel like, is what enabled this whole like FS Logix model to actually work.
Well, yeah, and it is the reason for this, you know. So it was a talk that at a Briforum, by the way, that Chetan gave about the next generation of coders, because everything is in memory now. Mm-hmm. With, you know, I got my career started as a programmer. We'd go so way out of our way, make sure we wouldn't cache anything to disk, make sure nothing got cached. Everything had to stay in RAM. And there's a variety of practices that you can do as a program to do that. And then Randy and I were at a presentation with Chet and said, if you're doing this now, you're wasting time. All right, you're absolutely wasting time, because even if you think it's going to disk, it's staying in RAM with technologies like Atlantis. And we were like, ding, hey, if that is true, then why are we trying to say, you know, disk space? And, you know, in truth was, when I was at VMware, we were owned by EMC. And, you know, in 5 short years, that might change as well. It might flop. But the EMC guys told me, hey, you know, you're not the only ones who know that this is a problem of high storage costs for Windows desktops. We're working on solving it as well. And, you know, like any problem, right, you have a variety of vendors who are out there solving that now. So it's just storage is not a factor anymore. Combine that with technologies like vSAN or MCS or PVS, and it's streamed out anyway. Who cares how big the image gets?
You mentioned VMware being owned by EMC. Let me ask you, shift gears a little bit and ask the question. So Kevin... So Tektar bought us, Brian Madden Company, in 2008. And, you know, so this is something that, you know, Gabe and Jack was with us at the time also, and we were just sort of discussing internally. But the first person I called externally when that happened in 2008 was Kevin.
You called Kevin first. It's cool. I'm not offended.
And
I'm sure the first thing I said was, did you call Kevin?
Yeah, because I was like, so this like company, you know, wants to maybe buy us. Like, what? How does this work? And Kevin is sort of my like advisor slash mentor during the entire process. Like, they sent documents, and I'm like, what do they mean here? What are they asking? It's like literally, you know, like in the scene in Office Space when they have to like look up money laundering in the dictionary. That's kind of how it was. For me, when they're like, oh, what are your blah, 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 some financial term? And I'm like, hey, Kevin, what in the hell is this? And so my point is, and since that time, I've gone back to Kevin with like business type questions, not just for our business, but when certain things happen. Like, you know, we talked about the Elliott thing with Elliott, you know, like the letter
elevated interest in Citrix.
Yeah. And like, yeah. Kevin explained it to me. I'm putting on the spot here, Kevin. So Elliot also did something, you know, with EMC. I think it was actually like back in January. They were talking about, you know, they wanted EMC to spin off VMware. And then that kind of like bubbled back up in the past few weeks. Kevin, have you been following this like Elliot VMware story at all?
Yeah, absolutely. So I, you know, I left VMware, but that didn't mean I sold all my stock in VMware. So I'm interested from an outsider. I obviously don't. I have no inside information on this, but I've never, ever seen an outside investor for any company. I mean, you know, automobile manufacturers onto computer companies to anything in the world who didn't have a 10% investor outside who wanted one, okay? As you sit on the board of directors, so the corporation has no life itself. It's given to life by legal documents, and then you have a fiduciary responsibility as CEO and others to, A, first the shareholders, and there's probably a charter within, there was one in Brian Madden, there's probably one in TechTarget that says, you know, what are your goals are for this corporation and what are you going to live by, right? But nobody from the outside, I've just never seen anyone from the outside come in and say, do you know, if you did this stuff now, 10 years from now, it would really make the world a better place. They don't do it. What they say is come in now and let's do some surgical, tactical, precision moves that will bring up the price of the stock because, and I know nothing about Elliott, and I'd be shocked. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot next, right? I'd be shocked if Elliott hasn't called you about this because you're an industry expert. At least on the Citrix side, you should be talking to them. They should get your opinion on what you think. But Elliott has a responsibility to their shareholders, and the people that are hoping to get an investment out of them, they don't really say to Elliott, wow, you know, we're going to have less trees. The world's going to be a less greener place in the year 2025 unless you invest in these companies. No, they say, hey, I'm retiring in 2 years. What's the status of my account? These guys come and go in every industry, and every board has to deal with them. And I don't know anyone who enjoys it, you know. They're the Carl Icahn of the virtualization industry.
So it's – okay, so that seems to be the pretty common what I want to call this, viewpoint among people in the industry, regardless of what, you know, Elliott's points about Citrix and value of stock and all that kind of stuff. The industry sort of perspective from, like, the IT nerd standpoint is like – oh, these outside financial people are coming in to, like, you know, mess up our nice little corner of the world.
But you're saying that happens all the time. Is this just, I mean, has this been happening to Citrix, do you think, forever? And this is just the most public of those occurrences?
Well, so it is unfortunately one of the side benefits of growing big enough to matter. You know, the California pension, CalPERS, doesn't put that. To date, let's say anyway, hasn't put any money in FS Logix. And then and said, you know, Kevin, I really think you ought to sell off that business. They haven't done that yet. So it is a bonus from growing up to be the size that a VMware or a Citrix has gotten to recently. And do you know what? You know, sometimes it makes perfect sense. Should Apple sit on a lot of that cash so they pay a dividend? There was someone who was calling that out to Apple to pay that money back to the shareholders and stuff like that. So every company that's big enough gets somebody like this who wants to get more money for their investment.
So how does this work? Like EMC owns VMware, but VMware's public. So when VMware went public, like, they just decide how much of the company that they're going to make public, right? Like, if a company goes public, it's not everything. You're saying, like, I'm going to take 10% of my company, which is, I think, what VMware did, and sell that to the public. But the other 90% is still owned by the original owner.
Well, I believe EMC. Yeah, I believe EMC did that. They decided to put out there. And, you know, there are, you know, for a while, I think HP had what they called tracking stocks on some of their divisions that you could buy and invest in just that division. And that's, you know, that's more common than you may think out there. And then EMC can then decide what to do with their other 80 to 90% of their investment. And far over my head how to decide, combined with that and all the other companies EMC owns, how to roll that up and determine it if you're getting your money's worth. I don't think there's anyone who'll say that they haven't gotten their money's worth out of their VMware investment.
Yeah, and yeah. I guess this is from Elliott's standpoint. This doesn't really matter, but they're looking at, you know, EMC owns a bunch of companies, right? They own RSA, they own VMware, they own VCE, they own Pivotal. And so I think Elliott's saying, hey, you know, these companies are sort of out there competing against each other and kind of, you know, competing and not competing, and it'd be good if you just consolidated all this together. But I guess that's...
Yeah, and so I don't understand the downstream merger where they're going to say, hey, the name is VMware and it'll end up being HP. But imagine if VMware was sold off and you own stock in VMware. Now it can be an acquisition candidate of somebody like Cisco or something else like that and get even more for your money. If that happens... Today, I don't know how you'd figure out the valuation with EMC owning so much of it. I'm sure it can be done. It can always be done, right? It's just a paperwork that would have to be done. But you might get more for your money. There are a lot. I believe you're, you know, if you for take Citrix Online, for example, you spin that off, Citrix stock might go up. You might get some money for that, and Citrix Online might can stand alone by itself. Take Netscaler, though. I believe if you sell off Netscaler, then you're going to make it very hard for the Citrix SEs to plan your installation if they have to add that into the mix and they don't get a chance to roll that into the price, right? Because now it's owned by somebody else who has to make their own profit on it. So there, you know, it all is important for the CEO of the company or his team to decide which of those are actually expendable assets, as opposed to what maybe an outside investor might think is expendable assets, you know?
Yeah, and I guess at the end of the day, Gabe's article, I think, sums it up, because a lot of us in the industry were kind of getting bent out of shape about Elliott coming in. And Gabe, your point was like, well, you know, they own $1 billion worth of their stock, so like or not, they get a vote.
Yeah, and it was more to what was the quote from Gross Point Blank? Like, if I'm showing up at your door, chances are you did something to bring me here.
Yeah. Oh, okay, fair enough. And typically what happens, here's my prediction, right? That the new CEO will come in and he'll say, the one thing we're going to do is get back to our roots, what made us great, you know, and we're going to stop going off on these ancillary projects and stuff. Why do I say that? Because that's what the new CEO of Symantec said. That's what the new CEO of Microsoft said. That was what the new CEO of Ford said. That's what the new CEO of GM said. You know, every guy who comes in, the first thing they know for sure is they're not here because the board wanted things to stay the same.
Yeah. Well, so almost by definition, yeah, you just look at what could they do that's different. That's what they're going to do.
Well, that's the larger discussion there is, okay, so yeah, that's going to happen. I mean, that was in the letter that Elliott published before all this stuff went down, or that was our first awareness of it, was that they're going to get back to their core stuff. And that's where we start to see GoTo up for sale. We see what was the Byte Mobile has been put up on the block. So they're already starting to kind of trim those far out things that Citrix is sitting on. But so to the discussion, though, and most of it comes from Dan Shapir in the comments of the articles that we write, is Citrix is going to focus on their core, which is technology that is, he believes, is on the way out. You know, but now I think that Windows is going to be around long enough and Windows applications are going to be around long enough that there's plenty of time to refocus on that and then figure out where to go. But, you know, the future is probably not Windows and Windows applications. And so Citrix still needs to find somewhere to go with their technology. That's different. I mean, Ford can refocus on what they do best, and that's make cars, and we're always going to need cars. I don't know what happened with Symantec when they did that. but Citrix, on the other hand, Citrix has to focus on Zenap and Zen Desktop. Yeah, that's true. So, right, so they can get back to that. And so Citrix is going to focus back on Windows applications from the data center in a world that's a little bit different than it was when they were, you know, first starting and when they were ridiculously successful at all of it. So they still have a challenge of finding out where to go after they refocus on core. Refocusing on core is step one. They still have to figure out where to go from there.
Well, yeah. How about those 750 million low-hanging desktops?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Why don't we figure out why they're not converting and then fix that problem, you know? Yeah. Come up with a solution to that.
This is a good segue because, you know, Windows 10, a lot of people are making a lot of fuss about how, oh, this is the last version of Windows. Or they say, or you know, is this the last version of Windows? And the reality is, you know, even Microsoft, when they've said things along those lines, that doesn't mean that it's a point in time freeze. It just means that instead of waiting every 5 years and releasing a major version of Windows, they want to just keep on like trickling out updates, you know, weekly, monthly, quarterly, and it's just sort of updated bit by bit by bit. So I think Windows in 2020 will be as different from now as it is now from 2010. It's just that instead of getting there in a big waterfall, we get there like, you know, bit by bit over the years. Because at the end of the day...
Yeah, the Windows we deploy, you know, the Windows 10 that gets deployed in organizations in, you know, this December is going to be Windows 10 LTSB1. And in 5 years, it's going to be Windows 10 still. So it was the last version of Windows, but it's going to be Windows 10 LTSB, you know, 6 or 8 or whatever the long-term build is. So yeah, technically speaking, Windows 10 is the last version of Windows, but only in name.
Yeah. So last week, by the way, on Windows, this is a little bit of a gear shift, but we were talking about all of these code, all these things Microsoft was doing for new applications on Windows and new all that kind of stuff, and we asked a bunch of questions like how side-by-side apps, well, maybe that's not the right word, how the apps like. Universal apps, yeah, like all these universal apps and store apps versus, and is it the same kernel, like the same app running your Xbox and your phone and your desktop and all kind of stuff. And we basically came out of that podcast more confused than when we went into it. And I know, Gabe, you sort of took it on. You drew the long straw from the podcast last week and kind of dug into all this. And I'm curious about what you learned.
Here's what I learned. I learned that I'm very glad that United has Wi-Fi on all their planes because I had a lot of travel time and I needed to do a lot of research for this one. So basically, I knew the words that Jack knew. We said everything we knew about this last Tuesday, which was code words, and then we couldn't really go too much further from there. So what we started to talk about was We started to talk about Windows like Project Astoria and Project Islandwood, and there's a few other project names that get thrown around, like Project Centennial and Westminster. And these are all part of something called the Universal Windows Platform. But also part of that is Continuum and Universal Apps. And somehow we knew these were all related to each other, but we couldn't describe it. We just knew they were related. And we stumbled around it for probably 3 minutes too long last week in trying to describe it. And so I set out to figure out what's going on. And so, in short, the Windows bridge for Android is what was previously called Project Astoria. And you can think of this as sideloading APK apps. Like if you have the APK Android application package, you can run that natively on Windows 10 mobile. It'll just run on an ARM-based Windows system. And it does that with an Android subsystem, much like the POSIX subsystem that we might remember from way back when. And so when we first heard Windows or running Android on Windows, that's literally what it means. You can run Android apps on Windows. Now, if that app requires stuff that's in the Google mobile services and all of that, that's a different story. And Microsoft has tried to replicate features of that so that apps that require it can work, but effectively, if you have an Android application that was made to just run on the regular Android open source project, that's what Microsoft has implemented in Windows 10 or Windows 10 Mobile, and you can run only those Android apps.
Okay, but now Windows 10 is the same kernel across everything, so would that also work on Windows desktop, like what BlueStacks does, or is that not a thing?
That's not a thing, because this is still bound to ARM. We'll get into universal apps here in a second, but the way that Windows universal apps work and can work between platforms is not the same as the way Android apps work. Basically, they took the Android open source project and made that into its own subsystem that runs on Windows 10 mobile only. So there's no ARM emulation or anything going on.
So it's not really like a VM. It's sort of like just...
It's like Wine. They have a separate API that Android can talk to.
Yeah.
So that's somewhat helpful, but again, only on Windows 10 mobile. So, you know, pretty limited. The other one was Windows or Project Islandwood, which is now called the Windows Bridge for iOS. And this is on the surface, you can say like, this is pretty much the same thing as what Android does, but with iOS. And really, it's not that way at all. This doesn't work by creating a subsystem. It actually... What Microsoft did was they extended Visual Studio so that it supports compiling code, compiling Objective-C code. And so basically just Visual Studio now, you can write iOS or Objective-C apps in Visual Studio.
And compile them to run on Windows then.
And compile them to run on Windows, exactly.
So is the idea that your package you have from Xcode for your iOS app, you just pop into Visual Studio and click compile, and you now have a Windows mobile version?
Yes. It's a separate app, though. So it's not like you're taking your iOS app and running it on Windows. You actually have to have access to the source code and recompile it for Windows. So you're porting it.
Is that compiling for Windows Mobile only on ARM, or can you compile that for Windows like desktop?
That's where it's interesting, because this is everything now. So you could compile it for Windows 10 Mobile on ARM, or you could compile it for Windows 10, x86, 64-bit, you name it. It'll compile for anything, because now we're pulling it into Visual Studio. So basically, they made Visual Studio aware of Objective-C code. So now, that's only part of it, though.
Just as people are moving to Swift.
that's later. So Swift support is in the works. But that's only part of it, though. That's only getting the application code to execute. There's still lots of different services that iOS apps take advantage of, too. And so Microsoft has implemented their own limited set of APIs to replicate what Apple does so that iOS applications can still interact with, say, like the Windows Store and with sensors.
So they almost have to do like a find and replace macro. Like everything that in your code that calls the Apple Push Notification Service API, they find and replace with Microsoft Push Notification.
Yeah, API. And the amount of effort that you have to put in, Microsoft has used they've used very subtly different terms. For Android, Jack, you might be able to correct me. I think it was they said that you can run Android applications with few code changes. And then for iOS, they say you can run iOS applications with minimal code changes. And it's true with Android. if your Android app runs on the Android open source project, it should just run with no problem whatsoever. You need to have your few code changes when you start to get into apps that require Google mobile services. With iOS apps, you're changing something. You just have to. You're using Microsoft APIs now. You have to, you've got to compile it separately for Windows. And so it's not, and you have to have access to the source. So you're not just going to go somehow pull out an application package from your phone and all of a sudden have it loaded in Windows. Like, you need to have access to the source code. So all this stuff is for separate developer arrangements or agreements or for homegrown apps. So that's those. It sounds great, but it's always more complicated than you think. But
these are called the bridge. So this is bridge for iOS and bridge for Android.
Right. And so all these are bridges into the universal apps feature, I guess, that Microsoft has. And so there's a couple other bridges. There's the Windows bridge for classic Windows, which was called Project Centennial. And this is basically
the past.
Yeah. But this is taking classic apps and using something like AppV to turn them into packages that are also bundled in a way that they can be delivered via the Windows Store. And that's part of the key here. Being a universal app, these things are bridges to making an application into something that can be delivered via the Windows Store.
Now, how does that work, though? Because a lot of the classic Windows apps use like lots of things, APIs and whatnot, that are not available to Windows Store apps.
That is true, and that's what the bridge for classic Windows does. So I did not dig in too deeply to the classic Windows. Tim Mangan wrote an article about it, so I linked to that. So I could not describe that to you
in so much detail. Tim's next. After VMworld, let's get Tim, and he can explain what the heck this means.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Yeah.
The other one was the Windows bridge for web, which same thing, but for web apps. So you define a scope of URLs, basically, that a web app has access to, and then there's more to it than that. But you can then publish the browser version of an application via the Windows Store. So all of these fit into the Windows apps or universal apps discussion, and that's where like Continuum comes in and the multiple UIs depending upon the platform and all of this. So when you make a universal application, you're taking the same basic code and wrapping different UIs around it. So universal apps are made with the understanding that there's certain APIs that are available on all the platforms. And so this could be a limited set of APIs. I mean, there are – let me try to rephrase this. I haven't spoken about it. I just wrote it. It's way easier to write about. So universal apps aren't necessarily – they don't necessarily work on every device. You focus on a device type when you make a universal application. And so you can make an you can make an application that works across all the platforms, but there's a limited number of APIs that are available to you if you're doing that, because Windows 10 Mobile doesn't have the same capabilities as Windows 10, you know, Pro on X64. So you can create an application that is a universal application, but that basically just means that it's available to you in the Windows Store, depending upon the device family that you've made this application for. So you could make one for across the whole spectrum, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that.
Yeah, and so in order to get into the Windows Store, you know, if I have a classic, like you were talking about Project Centennial, so I have a, you know, classic Windows app and I want it to go into the store, then I have to use that bridge. If I have a web app and I want it to go in store, I have to use the Windows bridge for web apps. And yeah, the same is true for iOS and Android. I think the main goal that I saw it as anyway was to get your app into the App Store.
It's into the Windows Store. Yep, exactly. Yeah. And because you're not going to deploy a classic app to a mobile phone, to a Windows 10 mobile device. But you can get it into the App Store so that you can use the App Store to manage that application.
Yeah, and I buy apps for the iPhone that are different from apps I buy from the iPad, and I don't have a problem with that. I will tell you, we have customers who come to us and say, I would like to sideload or bypass the Windows Store, and this is on 8. Now, I haven't heard what changes they made on 10, if it's still you know, giving problems to enterprise corporate app, you know, enterprise shops. But how can I bypass that store altogether and still show some of the apps that we did get from the store? You know, if you bypass that store, your apps show up with a little error next to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was just talking to somebody about that today. There's a lot of hope that you're going to go through that store, but a lot of enterprise shops are going to want to bypass it as well.
Which is exactly what we saw, like, in the mobile space, when the only way to get apps was through the, you know, Apple or Google Play Store. And one of the biggest requests is enterprises, like, hey, how do we give our App Store users directly, not through the store?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, speaking of mobile, Jack, you know, this has been a sort of a desktop-focused conversation since we got Kevin and stuff, but you know, you've had a couple articles this week. What are you up to? What's on your mind?
Hang on. Before we get to Jack, I still have – we didn't talk about Continuum yet.
Oh.
So the last part of this whole Windows Universal or Universal Windows platform thing is Continuum. And that's the – we know about Continuum as, you know, if I've got one of those two-in-one devices, I can disconnect the screen and it turns into a tablet mode. But it also works from connecting a device like a phone – up to a monitor, and once it knows there's a monitor, it can switch the UI around and show you a desktop UI. And so the way that works is with the universal application, you can actually build in different UIs into that application, and so it knows then which one of them to use depending upon which form factor it detects it's in, which I'm pretty sure it's just based on whether or not there's a keyboard attached or a monitor. So in this case, you know, you could actually take a Windows 10 mobile phone, plug it into a monitor, and then run Office on it. And instead of getting the mobile version of Office, it would know that it was connected to a monitor, and it would show the actual full same desktop UI version of Office that you would see if you were running it on your laptop. That works because it was written as a universal application. And so it works within the confines of that API. In that scenario with the Windows Phone, you could still have Windows Mobile applications running on the phone and have the desktop stuff showing on the desktop UI showing on the monitor. But there's no desktop actually on there. There's a little menu that lets you choose applications, but it's not a Windows desktop like we had with Windows RT that was very confusing. So you can use your phone as a trackpad then. This is a whole Nirvana phone kind of a thing. Or you can choose to use it with mobile applications and still use it as a phone and all of that. This is the thing that, like, I think Jack went off on a rant after we got off the podcast. He's like, I just don't even care.
Oh, I do. I do. Ooh.
So here's this seems really cool to me. Like this seems somehow better than the Nirvana phone concept where your phone's a thin client. The fact that all my stuff is actually on my phone and I can use it in that way seems better to me. So sorry to keep you up, but go ahead, Kevin.
Oh, so here's what I want to use it for. I want to take my iPhone or iPad into that customer location and hook it up to his overhead screen and leave my laptop home. But what I really want is they have an 8K display device up there, and I want my version of Windows that's been written for Continuum. Excuse me, my version of PowerPoint that's been written for Continuum to recognize that display and show all my rich graphics and everything else like that. Mm-hmm. But when I'm sitting at the restaurant with the guy who meets me for lunch, I'm going to do the same thing on my iPad, and I want it to, you know, and it works now on the iPad, but I don't have that Nirvana connection up to that big screen where it lets me truly leave one device home.
Have you? Yeah, I mean, is that something you want to do? I've never really wanted to. I can't use my tablet to type on. I can't create content with my tablet. And so when I'm on
Kevin's
the road,
not
I
talking have about creating content.
Yeah, you're just talking about showing it, but you're telling me you're not working on this PowerPoint?
I'm going out to a customer location and showing it, and I want to leave my laptop in the car, or I want to leave it at the hotel. Sure, I want to use my laptop at night. What did Mark Templeton call it when you want to snack on data as opposed to actually, you know, create the data? There are plenty snacking opportunities for me that I don't get to take advantage of because I don't have this app that recognizes what form factor I'm on and allows me to show, you know, rich media up on that big screen. That's a small use case, but that was my absolutely would use it for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So anyway, so that's the Continuum discussion there. I mean, that was this allows you to switch UIs between universal apps, between device types.
All right. So I feel like and this kind of stuff, too, you know, this is all just coming out now. So it'll be the proof is in the pudding, as they say, about what people will actually use and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and I don't know how valuable running iOS, compiling iOS apps for Windows is going to be, or running Android apps natively on Windows Mobile on ARM is going to be. You know, it's cool that it's there, and you can see that, you know, that could, if this was done when Windows 8 was released, it would have evolved into something by now that might be usable. And so now I'm just kind of sad that we have to wait 3 more years to see what this evolves into. Maybe we won't have to wait that long, but I'm anxious to see where it goes.
Yeah, me too. I think this is, we talked about this a lot before. I'm excited about this too. All right, Jack, what's on your mind?
This week, I'll close out with a fun bit of trivia that I spent actually considerable time last week figuring out. Project Origami, Project
VMware.
Horizon,
right.
Horizon App Manager, Horizon Workspace, Workspace Portal, Identity Manager. Now, of course, two of those are project names that don't count. But what I was writing about that came out – was this? Yes, what I was writing about that came out on Monday was the VMware and AirWatch integration. And, of course, a big component of that came out in June as I was speaking on the podcast last week with VMware Identity Manager. It brings that, you know, the workspace that delivers access to any application to any device. It takes VMware's product and now makes it much more mobile aware. So this is the product that I'm going to be interested in watching and looking at VMworld. Last week I was, when I was trying to talk about it, I was confused a little bit. And but now that I you know, went back and refreshed my memory of how and when exactly those six different names for the product came about, we're in good shape.
And the current – so all those products names you mentioned, the current one is called?
VMware Identity Manager.
Identity Manager. The Horizon
Workspace Portal still exists. But the confusing thing that VMware kind of did without like making it explicit, you know, anytime a product name is changed is confusing, and maybe as bloggers we're the only ones that really care. But last year when like they took the Horizon term and instead of Horizon referring, you know, in general to anything workspacey, Horizon was, you know, now it's only, you know, Vue and a few other desktop products.
So Horizon is – so Vue is gone. Horizon
– No, Vue is still here. It's – there's Horizon Vue.
And what's the RDS – is there Horizon
– Or it's all Horizon, just Horizon 6.
Yeah, it's all Horizon 6, and then that includes Vue and the RDSH stuff. But I don't know if Vue is still around, because if you go to like VMware, I just did this the other day too. If you search for VMware Vue and click on the link for VMware Vue that pops up in Google, it takes you to the Horizon 6 page.
But also, if you go through their page, you know, like that lists all of their products, the term Vue is still used. So, and you know, we it's a big company, so there's obviously some inconsistency in, you know, pages that don't get updated to new names and everything.
Basically, Horizon is just Windows now.
Yes.
It will include, I'm sure it'll include their Linux VDA when that comes out, but yeah.
Just desktop. Identity Manager is the web portal stuff, but web portal is still a separate thing too.
Identity Manager is the mobile aware version. So Identity Manager, because if you think about it, there are really two components here. There's like a client portal, but there's also the fact that there's a whole, you know, in the identity space, you know, the SSO Federation stuff, there's a component called, you know, Identity Manager that's running as an identity provider. You know, so that you can do all your single sign-on and log into everything. But think of Identity Manager as – think back to 2010 when you write an article like why VMware Horizon is going to be, you know, the bee's knees and mm-hmm. And the future and everything. We've been waiting for – you know, for years that included obviously web apps and, you know, desktop apps in various ways. One of the things that we've been waiting for is access into native mobile apps. And this is something I can remember, Brian, you and I having conversations about this like 2011, 2012, even before I worked at TechTarget. But now with VMware Identity Manager, and now that they've had a while to bring the AirWatch stuff in, this is finally bringing all that native mobile access in there too. So this is like one more, a greater degree of completeness of that, you know, vision that we were talking about 2010, 2011.
Yeah. All right. And I guess we'll see next week.
So you should be excited about it.
Yeah, we'll see you next week. We can sort this out afterwards just in case they change anything else next week.
Yeah.
So let me finish on this. Kevin, so you'll be at VMworld, I guess, next week, yeah?
I don't know. Is the I actually hadn't booked my trip yet. I'm trying to find a reason to go.
Oh, really? Well, you know, you're welcome to stay here if you...
Is the VMware frat house? I thought you had permanent house guests.
Oh, so they our other brother moved to the Bay Area, but they actually got like an apartment and all that kind of stuff. So they're not here anymore. And so yeah, last year we had like, I don't know, four or five people stay. We was at my house, I think it was what Sean, Rick, you, Gabe. If you make it out here, you've got a place to stay. Are you looking forward to anything from VMworld? I mean, even from the news standpoint, is there anything you feel like that they need to answer, what you're hoping to find out next week?
Well, just on a personal note, I want to hear more about Project Enzo, of course. You know, that's their just-in-time desktops, and we want to see how FS Logix fits into that. the Enzo includes their app volumes and their user environment manager pieces, right? So I'm not sure. I'd like to hear when that's shipping. Didn't they announce that at Briforum? I think they did at a Lunch and Learn or something like that. So that's where I, I believe Project Fargo comes in. So those are the two things I'm interested in.
Yeah.
So, and then I want to hook up with Sean Bass, CTO, VMware. That's the other thing.
Wait, he's CTO?
Didn't he get promoted to CTO? I saw that on Twitter.
Oh, sweet. That's awesome. Well, congrats. There's talk about him sort of acting. Sure, I'm just on his LinkedIn right now.
Good for him.
CTO, Desktop Technologies at VMware. Oh, for goodness sake. Well, congratulations, Sean. We were talking about this actually a few weeks ago. There is not a better person to be a desktop CTO for VMware than Sean. And I mean, you know, that dude is just, he gets it. He talks to lots of people. He's very passionate. He works hard, works a lot. I feel like he has the right history also, because he's very outspoken as, you know, a member of the community and everything. So I feel like if there's going to be someone in there, I feel like this is nice to have one of like our guys. And I'm saying that for someone who's been in the trenches in the world of, you know, terminals for VDI, Citrix for decades. That's super awesome. So man, congrats. I know he's not on the phone to say thank you, but
well, I'm sure he would. Madden on something. I didn't realize you didn't know that. Yeah, I saw that on Twitter.
Yeah, scooped me.
I had heard that he might as well be the CTO before, but I did not hear that he actually had become the CTO.
Yeah.
So
do you know what? Do you know what? A year ago, when he was asking me, "Hey, what do you think? Am I gonna like working at VMware and all that other stuff?" In my mind, I saw him as the CTO of Citrix. You know. I'm sure they have a group of very nice CTOs at Citrix, but I don't actually know any of them. But I always thought he would make it, you know, because of his Citrix background. But this just puts him in the perfect place at VMware. And that's a group of things where he can make a huge difference there.
Yeah, well, that's awesome for him. I'm looking forward to next week. Like, I mean that honestly. Like, I really am excited about next week. And I just feel like there's a lot of interesting stuff happening in our industry right now. And I just can't wait to hear how it all goes together. So if you do not join us in person, Kevin, then, you know, we'll be doing a couple, I think we're doing two maybe live podcasts from the show floor next week. We're doing the Best of VMworld awards also. So I think Gabe and I will be judging the desktop category or the UC category, whatever they're calling it. But yeah, should be a good week. Starts on Sunday this year. So looking forward to it.
Alrighty.
Well, thanks, Kevin, for taking the time and for hanging out a little past. Thank you for bookending our, you know, this is episode 109 of the podcast. I'm going to level jump because we didn't count the first 32 episodes we did. Like, we started counting the podcast when we sort of relaunched them, you know, a couple years ago. We started over the count at one. So I'm going to jump right to 109 because this is the 109th podcast we did, which is funny because it's like, wow, 109 podcasts. That's so prolific. It's been 10 years, so less than one a month. But they're fun. So thank you for joining us again, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'll see you in 2025, I guess, huh?
Yeah, with your new company.
Please no.
Still dealing with some Windows anomaly that's a pain in our butts.
And
it'll be T-Scale for 64-bit.
It'll be the seven users who still have it.
Oh, man. Well, I'll be one of them. Fantastic. So, Gabe, thank you. Jack, thank you. Justin, our engineer, Mariah, our manager, thank you all. And thank you for listening. And we'll talk to you all next week at VMworld.